So it's, I'm just really delighted to be here. I'm delighted that it's part of the nonprofit leadership, actually I can say part of the nonprofit leadership day, right, that the provost talked about, but also part of the nonprofit leadership studies program. You know, I learned at lunch today that this is the largest program, not in West Kentucky, not in the Bluegrass State, not in the South, but in the entire United States, which is pretty good. Go ahead, give yourself a round of applause. Which is pretty good. And I also want to say that you see this guy taking pictures over here. I've had a relationship with Bob Long for about a decade now. He's been a friend of mine, a mentor of mine, a colleague of mine. I'm glad he's here and at Murray State. And so just a round of applause for all the great work he does. I want to talk today about the fact that I think many of us think that this country is on the wrong path and what it's going to take to put us on a better path, and what it is that we in this room as nonprofit leaders can do to help this country and our communities be stronger and more vibrant and better. I'm here tonight in part because I'm traveling across the country as part of something we're calling the Reclaiming Main Street campaign. I've been in Washington, D.C., I've been in Oakland, California, I've been in Michigan, I've been at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, I'm going to Spartanburg, South Carolina, I leave here today, go to New York, and then I go to Colorado Springs, all with this very simple message, that we're on the wrong track, that we've got to get on a better path, and that the way to do it is that we've got to make community a common enterprise in our country again, where we're not going it alone on our own, but where we come together and demonstrate that we actually can believe in ourselves and in one another, that we have the power, the wisdom, the know-how to get things done, to solve the problems that we face in our community, and to build, I'm looking out across this crowd, to build an inclusive society where everyone has a place at the table. And I mean everyone, not just some of us, but all of us. That we need to get on with the business of building a common enterprise. And I think it's got to start in our local communities. I live in Washington, D.C., and I can tell you, you know, the folks in Washington, D.C. are not going to be the leaders of this parade. They don't have an interest in doing it. They don't have a stake in doing it. They don't believe they need to do it. And I think the only way in which we're going to get Congress and the White House and our national politics on a better course is if our communities show the way. And I think that has to start with us in this room as being nonprofit leaders. And I think of you now as nonprofit leaders, not future ones, but ones that are actually thinking about this now. And so I think that's important. You know, I'm sure you heard some time ago about the shooting that took place in Newtown, Connecticut, Sandy Hook Elementary School. Back in December 2012, 20 first graders were gunned down and 6 adults were murdered by a 19-year-old gunman who walked into the Sandy Hook Elementary School and took their lives. Some weeks after the Sandy Hook tragedy occurred, I was called by the mayor of Newtown, a woman named Patricia Lodra, who asked me whether or not I'd be willing to come to Newtown and design and lead a process by which that community could figure out how to move forward and what to do with the Sandy Hook Elementary School. I thought about it and agreed to do it. And what I found when I went there was that the mayor had created a task force of 28 political leaders from 4 different governing boards to be a special group to make this decision. Now, these leaders, as you can imagine, you know, they'd never worked together. And in fact, they were often political rivals. And this was a recipe for political grandstanding after one of the greatest tragedies our country has seen in terms of someone walking into school and taking the lives of young children. It was an opportunity for them to pursue their own personal agendas, to pursue their own way of solving this problem, and to figure out that they could somehow go it alone and persuade the community to follow them. All of our meetings were held in public. At each meeting, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and CNN and the major news stations from New York City and all the radio stations from all around came and covered our meetings. At about the fourth meeting, going into the fourth meeting of leading this, I had announced that we were ready to make a decision. The Wall Street Journal had run an article on the front page of their second section that said, Newtown is ready to make a decision about Sandy Hook Elementary School and move forward. As I arrived in town, I learned that 30 teachers had written a letter, 30 teachers from Sandy Hook Elementary School, who said, we will never go back to that school. and we will never go back to the site of that school. And so despite the fact that all of our meetings were in public and there were hundreds of people that had come into the town hall chambers to watch this fourth meeting, families of victims, families of survivors, and others, we went into that meeting and cleared the room and cleared the media. And for the only one time, we met in private with those 30 teachers. It was one of the most harrowing experiences I've ever had in my life. To listen to those teachers talk about how they, you heard some of these stories, how they took their young first graders and hid them in storerooms and in restrooms. I heard one teacher in tears crying, saying, I had to watch as one of my colleagues had been gunned down by this gunman. And she was reaching out for me, grasping for air and grasping for her life, and he riddled her with more bullets. And she passed away. And they told us again that we would never come back to this school. And so the night of that fourth meeting, when we reopened it to the media and to the public, I stood up. Very first thing I said was, we're not going to make a decision tonight. We're not ready. There are too many emotions going on. People aren't ready emotionally to move forward. We're kind of stuck. And I remember getting a call the next day from the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal in my office back in Washington saying, we told you this would be a failure. We told you this community could never come together. We told you this would never work. And what I said back to them was, this is the best thing that could have ever happened to this community. Because the closer we get to a big decision in our lives, the more we begin to understand the ramifications of what we're going to do. And so a week later, in a special fifth meeting, everyone came back. And I'll never forget this. One of the folks, her name was Laura, on the task force said, what I've come to understand over the last week or so is that this is an imperfect situation that we can't make perfect. The only way to make this situation perfect would be to rewind the clock before the gunman ever walked into the school. And that what we need to figure out on this task force and in this community is how is it that we move forward as best we can? How is it that we move forward as best we can? And so on that night, I think we all realized that this was not a decision about a building. This was a decision about whether or not a community that had been through trauma and despair could decide to step forward into healing and hope. And that night, we voted at the end of the evening. We had to take a vote. And we didn't split down the middle as many people thought we might, deadlocked and unable to make a decision. The task force didn't vote 2/3 to 1/3 to make a decision about what to do with the school. The task force made a unanimous decision to tear down the old building, to rebuild on the current site. And those teachers I talked about, many of them are planning to go back to that school. What I take away from Newtown is, yes, bad things happen, and there is evil in our world. But the message I take away, even more strongly than that, is that when we set our minds to it, and when we decide to come together, we can actually create change. And we can do it in a way in which we begin to believe in ourselves and in one another more than what we did before. And Newtown is now moving forward. Now, the fact is, as much as I believe we need to move forward together and make community a common enterprise, and as much as I believe that your generation has to be at the forefront of this movement, there are challenges in our country and in our communities that tell us we can't do it. We have too many leaders who are concerned more about their own agendas than our common agenda, and are more concerned about taking credit than in collaborating, right? That's my mother, tell her I'll call her back. She always calls when I'm talking. We have too many leaders, too many organizations. Too many organizations that are more concerned with their own survival and in getting funding than they are with the civic health of our communities. Our public discourse has become so acrimonious at times that what we do is we get together to point fingers at one another and cast aspersions about who's to blame for the problems we face, as opposed to trying to figure out what we hold in common and how we can move together and build a stronger community for everyone in our towns. And I'm told as I've traveled the country that so many of us, I don't know if this is true for you all here, so many of us have become obsessed with instant gratification. We want what we want, when we want it. If we don't like it, we get to return it, no questions asked. You think I'm talking about something you might have bought at Walmart or Target. But if you listen closely to the debate about our public schools, that's what it sounds like. I don't like my public school. I get to pull my kid out, go to some other place, and leave everyone else behind. But I ask you, what happens to the kids who are left behind? And what happens to the notion that public schools are here to help us create a democracy and strong communities? If we're going to invest in our communities, we're going to have to get past this instant gratification, because we need long-term investments in making sure our communities are healthy and thrive and strong. And that's going to require us to have the ability and the willingness and the desire to not see results tomorrow, but to make investments for 5 years from now and 10 years from now. Now, I happen to believe that if we're going to get past these challenges, we need a new breed of leader in our country. And I think you represent that new breed. I call these leaders public innovators. We help develop them in our work. And these public innovators that we work with, they have certain characteristics that I suspect many of you share. One is they hold ideals. But those ideals, they came with them. You came with them. They're not something that you were taught necessarily in a class, though that might have taken place. But there's something that you were born with, or your parents inculcated in you, or maybe a coach helped you develop, or a teacher somewhere along the way. Ideals that we can do better, and that we ought not to settle for where we are. But these public innovators that I work with, they have another characteristic as well. They believe that ideals alone are not enough, that talking alone is not enough, that we need to be pragmatic. These public innovators want to get things done. They want to know what works. And if something's not working, they want to move away from it and figure out what will work. And so in that sense, they're innovators, always looking for a better way to do things. And lastly, these innovators, they understand risk. Because to solve problems in our communities, we're going to have to take some risks. We're going to have to make ourselves visible. We're going to have to stand up in front of people and say there's certain things we have to do. But these innovators, they know how to calculate risks and not take foolhardy risks and foolish risks, but take risks that will matter and that have a chance to succeed, and not just tilt at windmills. I so believe that we need a new breed of leaders at the Institute, the Harwood Institute. I've set a new goal for us. By 2016, we're going to train up 5,000 public innovators across the country to help develop a cadre of innovators who can help us get on a different path. I've set a goal for the Institute that we have a public innovator corps, people who believe in this new direction, who want to use the tools and processes we've developed. We're going to grow it to 100,000 members so that we can create a groundswell, along with other groups and organizations in the country, to put us on a different path. And I hope many of you will become those public innovators as you move forward. Now, these public innovators, and just people who solve problems in their communities, what I've come to learn is they have a certain orientation that I want to talk about just for a minute. It's what we call they're turned outward toward the community. They're facing the community. Now, this isn't a skill or a technique or something you can go to a website and download, and you don't need to read one of my books to know about it. It's just something in your head, something in your mind, something in your heart that tells you that in order to work in communities, in order to put our communities on a better path, we need to be focused on our communities. We need to be turned outward toward them. Our orientation, our disposition, our mindset needs to be about community. And I say this because we've done millions of dollars of research and work on the ground, and what we've learned is so many of us are turned inward toward ourselves. And so many nonprofits, I'm sorry to say, are turned inward toward their own organizations. What I find is when nonprofits tell me they want to be more effective, what they say is, well, we're going to do another strategic plan. When they tell me they want to be even more effective, they tell me they're going to do another reorganization of their staff, move around the boxes. When they want to be especially more effective, they decide to do a new logo with a new slogan. Right? Now, the Institute, see that little red H up there? A couple years ago, we actually did spend some money developing a new logo. You like it? I kind of like it. We looked at the science of color, and it told us that, you know, we wanted to be more assertive and aggressive and more visible in the work we do. And the science of color told us we ought to move from blue to red. We did it. Right? It said we need an iconic logo. We did it. Now, I'm here to tell you what I know is, or what I hope, is that logo makes us more attractive. But what I also know is that it doesn't make us a lick more effective. It doesn't make us a lick more connected to our community. It doesn't mean anything that we understand the values and the hopes and the dreams of people and the challenges that they're wrestling with in their communities. When we turn inward, we end up focusing more on activities than we do on the action we need to take. We end up focusing more on the inputs of our programs than on the impact we're trying to create. We end up focusing more on public relations than we do on understanding people's reality and what it is that needs to be addressed in their lives. We spend more time treating people like consumers and customers of our services as if we have all the answers, and less time focusing on people as citizens or members of a community who have their own desire to engage with one another and to solve problems in their communities and to be part of something bigger than themselves. And so I think the first step, if we want to put our communities on a better path, if you want to be effective nonprofit leaders, what I've learned over the last 25, 30 years is the number one step we got to take is to turn outward toward our community. That's the number one thing. So I just want to mention three other things that we can do that will make a difference and help us get on a better path and make community a common enterprise again. You still with me here? All right. Number one, I think if we're going to fix our public discourse and get things moving in a positive direction, we've got to learn how to focus on people's shared aspirations, their shared aspirations. Right now, when we go into communities, I don't know if you've had much experience with this, when we go into communities, we do one of two things. This is the nonprofit reflex in our communities. This is what the media does too. Number one is we focus on people's problems. We ask them what's wrong. And if you've ever been in a conversation like that, inevitably, it focuses on our deficits, it tells us what we don't like, and inevitably it degenerates into people pointing fingers and wondering who's to blame for the problems and how do we get into this mess that we're in. And so when we don't do that, what we do is we decide to take some of these fancy visioning exercises. Have you ever seen these? These visioning exercises where you have the little yellow dots. You ever been involved in one of these? Okay. Well, I won't explain it now, but these visioning exercises where they ask people to dream, like if you live in Flint, Michigan, how can you be Palo Alto, California, right? And when you get experience with these visioning exercises, what you'll soon discover is that they always have large steering committees and hundreds of people involved, and you've been involved in these kind? And they always produce nice reports and printed in four colors on glossy paper with 160 committees and task forces about what's going to happen. And you look back a year from now and everyone in a community like Murray or someplace else, Paducah or someplace, starts to scratch their head and says, huh, I wonder whatever happened to that visioning exercise. Nothing ever came of it. It's usually sitting at the bottom of a pile gathering dust or in someone's file drawer. And the reason why is because we keep asking people to dream about a community they don't live in, to talk about a reality that bears no relationship to what they're living or where they really want to go or how something's going to help them tomorrow or the next day or the day after. It's totally untethered from reality. And anything untethered from a reality in public life and community, if you're interested in moving communities, doesn't move. Why? Because it's not relevant to people and their lives. It's simply not relevant. So here's an alternative. And you can do this in your residence hall, you can do this around the dinner table, you can do this by calling your parents on the phone, you can do this in your class tomorrow, you can do this in a community work that you're doing. Ask someone, what's your aspirations for your community? And I guarantee you they will say something about wanting to move forward, but it'll be connected to their reality. And what we find is when a community does this together, all of a sudden people realize we may not share everything in common, but we hold more in common than that which divides us. When people talk about their shared aspirations, all of a sudden they realize that no single nonprofit in a community could ever satisfy these. That we need a collection of groups, not just nonprofits, but the business community, the faith community. And importantly, we ourselves need to be part of it as well. Not as consumers or as customers of services, but as members of a community. And so when you came in tonight, did you get the little yellow card that said Town Hall? So what I'm going to ask you to do tonight before you go is either write your aspiration for your community down, or while I'm talking, if you're bored enough, pull out your smartphone. No professor ever said this to you, right? Pull out your smartphone and go to harwoodtownhall.com and you can just put in your aspiration for your community. What I can tell you is there are communities all across the country who are starting to do this. And what they're realizing is that rather than be divided, rather than hearing complaints about what's not going right in their community, they're starting to realize that actually they can make sure that every kid can read by the third grade, that single moms who have kids who need financial security can gain that financial security, that people who need health care can gain health care, and that every individual in their community is not simply maintaining themselves in survival mode, but actually has a real shot at the American dream. And I think that's what this is about. Okay, second thing. The first thing is focused on shared aspirations. The second is that if we're going to move forward, I think we need to focus on our shared responsibility. For too long, we've been on our own, going alone, believing that in kind of an instant gratification way, somehow we can make it by ourselves. But what we know is that's not possible. And it reminds me of a time I was in Las Vegas talking to about a dozen people. I was going across the country talking to people about the state of the country and where we are today and what they think we need to do, which resulted in a book I wrote called The Work of Hope, which I think we have some copies out front for you. As I was talking to folks there, about a dozen, 15 people, they were talking about their aspirations for Vegas and the challenges of education in Clark County and the homeless issue. And I said to them at some point, about 90 minutes into the conversation, I said, so what do you think we ought to do? What do you think needs to happen? And this guy sitting about three seats from me, I'll never forget him, he looked at me and he said, you know, what I think we need to do in Las Vegas and in communities across the country is I think we need to get folks just like the folks around the table. These aren't leaders, these are just normal folks in a community, just like us. We need to get folks like this around the table to come out from their homes, and we need to do something together. We need to paint a school together, is what he said. And I looked at him and I said, really? I was kind of incredulous. I said, after all the challenges you've mentioned here in Las Vegas and Clark County, you want to paint a school together? And he looked back at me across the table and he said, you know, Rich, you look like a nice guy. You dress kind of nicely, but you don't listen real well. You don't listen real well. He said, let me try it again. And this is what he said. I want to get folks to come out from their homes to paint a school together because too many of us are stuck in our homes and we're afraid of each other, we don't trust each other, and we need to get together and figure out how we can do something together. I want to paint a school so I can get folks out of the house and so we could set a goal together, because we don't set goals together as a community. I want to get folks around this table and in my community out from their house to set a goal together, and as we're trying to reach that goal, inevitably we will probably have a misstep and we'll fall down and we'll kind of like scrape our knee, and we need to demonstrate, not to other people, but to ourselves first and foremost, that we have the fortitude and the wherewithal and the will to get back up and to brush ourselves off and to keep going. And when we keep going, when we get to the point where we've painted the school, we need to celebrate something, because in our community, all we hear from the news media and politicians is bad news. And we never celebrate those things that we do together. He said, if we paint this school, maybe the kids in the school will realize that adults really care about them and they'll work harder. Maybe when those kids realize that, maybe their parents, who maybe haven't been putting their all in, will realize that others are surrounding the school and they'll want to be more involved as well. And maybe in some other part in Las Vegas, when they see us doing this, they won't maybe need to paint a school, but maybe they'll decide to get together and set their own goal about cleaning up a park or doing something else. He said, I don't think painting a school will fix our problems in Clark County education system. But he said, what I know is unless we come together as a community and start doing things together and rebuild our trust in one another and forge stronger relationships together and build our confidence that we can get things done, we will never get to those bigger issues. And that's what I'm here to say tonight. That we've got to make community a common enterprise here in our communities, where you live, where you go to school, because we've got challenges in our larger country that we need to deal with. But we don't have the trust and the relationships and the confidence to solve them now. And that's going to come from our working communities working together. What the folks in Vegas were telling us is something I heard as I traveled around the country. You know, when I went across the country listening to people talk, it was right after the Great Recession. And everyone told me about how their house was underwater, how they maybe had lost their mortgage. how they maybe had to pull a kid out of community college or maybe even out of Murray State, about how one of the parents or two of the parents lost their jobs and they were worried about whether or not they could make ends meet, about how a lot of Americans felt the rules are rigged against hardworking folks in this country. But you know what? Those weren't the number one issues they mentioned to me. They mentioned those issues. But the number one issue they mentioned was the following: that we need to restore our belief in ourselves and in one another, that we can come together and get things done. That was the number one issue Americans told me we needed to focus on in this country. And when I think the folks in Vegas and Atlanta, where I've been, and Spartanburg, and Michigan, and Kentucky, and Tennessee, and other places are telling us, is that this country is a country of builders. It's part of our DNA. It's part of who we are. It's how this country got built. It's how we ultimately got rid of slavery. It's how we faced up to child welfare laws and other kinds of things where we needed to set ourselves on a better and a more right course. This country has not cowered from its challenges. We've made tons of mistakes, but ultimately we come together and build again and build anew. And I think what the folks in Vegas and other people I've talked to in the country are saying is, we need to stop talking, we need to stop complaining, we need to stop pointing fingers, and we got to get together and start building and believing in ourselves again. So that's the second thing. We need more shared responsibility. Lastly, we need to pay attention to the stories we tell ourselves about our community. You know, in all of our heads, we tell stories about ourselves, right? We may look really confident, we may look really strong, but sometimes in our community, in our heads, we're telling stories about the things that are wrong with ourselves or the things that aren't working or our own insecurities. And as you know, those stories in our head, they shape our mindset about things, they shape our attitudes, they ultimately shape our behaviors and actions. And the fact is that what I've learned over 30 years of doing this work is that communities have stories they tell themselves, that we tell ourselves about our communities, that also shape our narratives about who we are and who we're becoming and whether or not we can do things. And as I talk about this, I often think about a time I worked in Youngstown, Ohio. And I got a phone call from a foundation president who worked in Youngstown. And the governor of Ohio had decided to take over the Youngstown public schools because they weren't performing. And they set up an academic distress commission. And the Academic Distress Commission of about 15 people created a long laundry list of education reforms, the kind that you could see on any generic website about education reform. And they were just about to release, oh, I'm on tape, right? Yeah. They were just, well, I said this to them anyway, so it doesn't matter. They were just about to release their education reform report. And lo and behold, they realized they hadn't talked to anyone in the community about their own public schools, about what people in that community wanted, what their aspirations were. And so they asked me, would I do it? Would my institute do it? And I said, under two conditions. One, I get to decide the questions we ask, and two, I get to decide who we're going to talk to. And they agreed. And so we went out and we engaged parents and adults in the community. And among other things, this is the main thing that we learned that they told us. They said, when we see kids in Youngstown walking down the street toward us, we cross the street. When we see kids in Youngstown walking down the street and we look at them, we think they're up to no good. When we see these kids in Youngstown, we think that they're all going to get into trouble with the law. When we look at these kids, we don't think they have the potential to learn. Think about it. That's the narrative of that community. That's the narrative. When we went to talk to students, after talking to them for a while, some of them said, you know, we know what those adults say about us. We know it because we see it. When we walk down the street, they cross the street. When they look at us, we can tell they think we're up to no good. They think we're all a bunch of crooks. They don't believe that we have the potential to learn. They don't believe we have the potential to lead. They see us unworthy. And so I ask you, in Youngstown, if you lived in Youngstown, and this was the narrative of the community, what makes us think that a 150-page education reform package that talks about all sorts of technical things. What makes us think that a young kid in the dead of winter in Youngstown, when it gets and it's still really dark in the morning when he or she wakes up, what makes us think that that kid's going to get up and take a shower, get dressed, go stand on a dark corner, and wait for a school bus to pick him up, and go to a school that doesn't believe in him? How is it that if that's the narrative of the community, that those kids are going to believe that they're valued and loved and believe that they have a shot at something in their lives? Now, the fact is that not every community has that narrative. But lots of communities that I've worked in have what I would call negative ingrained narratives about who they are, that change can't happen here. You go to small communities, rural areas. The narrative I hear all the time is, we tried that 30 years ago, it's not going to work here. It's not going to work here. I went to Vegas, I told you. When I worked there 10, 15 years ago, the narrative of that community was, believe it or not, I'm for me and you're for me. I'm for me and you're for me. And they couldn't solve common problems in that community of homelessness, people not getting good education, of water issues that they faced. In some communities, in thriving communities, maybe here in Murray, certainly in Bentonville, Arkansas, where I was last week, the narrative is, everything's fine, don't worry about it. Everything's fine, don't worry about it. Except in communities that have that narrative, what we know is, unless they put their nose to the grindstone and really work at continuing to move forward, at bringing new leaders in, of tackling the underlying challenges that are in their community that are bubbling up, those communities also stagnate and start to fall behind. We've got to pay attention to these narratives, because in our work, what we've found is these narratives actually help determine whether or not communities move forward or not. And so I think we've got to work on it. But let me tell you, as nonprofit leaders, what you don't want to do. To deal with these narratives, you don't want to hire a public relations consultant. Because what they're going to do is they're going to tell you to tell everyone in the community that everything's fine, that everything's working just great. They're going to tell you to hang signs from the streetlights that say our community is coming back, when people in their own lives know that things aren't working that well. It's a false hope message. And so instead, I think what we need to focus on, I think this is one of, kind of hope this will become part of the core curriculum here. I told him when he sat down, I said, this is great. You teach a class as a pilot and it becomes part of the requirements. Not bad. So I think what we need to focus on is how to tell each other not just stories, but what I would call parables, civic parables. You know, if you go to church, all parables have an implicit moral or a lesson to them, right? They're always teaching us something, but they don't hit us over the head with it. And all parables, good parables like the Good Samaritan, teach us about a journey. I was set off to do something, I encountered something, I did something, or I thought about something, I did something, I learned something. And if you've noticed, all good parables never have an ending, because they always implicate those of us who are listening or hearing them, because we actually could be the person who's the Good Samaritan the next time, who encounters that person on the path. And so we need to learn how to tell these civic parables, like the guys in Las Vegas who decide maybe to paint the school and set out and set a goal together. And as they're setting that goal, they fall down and make a misstep and get back up and keep going. We need to learn how to tell these stories, and we need to tell enough of them over time so they begin to create a new narrative, a new can-do narrative in our community, or in a place like Murray, a narrative that we're not going to settle for what is. We're going to keep trying to create the strongest, best community we can in Kentucky and in the country. We need to do that. Okay. You still with me? Do I have time for one more thing? You sure? All right. Thanks. So I just want to spend a minute, if I can, on a more personal note. I think each of us in this room, each of you, decided to become part of the nonprofit leadership studies for a reason. There was something inside of you that prompted you to do this. There's some, what I would call, an urge to do good, right? Some mission that you're on, some way to be part of something larger than yourselves, some way to make a difference in your communities, right? Do I have that right? And so I want to tell you a little bit about why I do the work I do. And I'm telling it in part so you know my own motivations. And I want to tell you it in part so maybe It will help you remember why you want to do this work as you move forward. So for me, when I was a kid, I was born and diagnosed with cystic fibrosis. In the early 1960s, when I was born, that was a death sentence. They didn't know how to deal with it. There was a point at which my mom went to the doctors who were taking care of me, and they said, "Face it, this kid's a lemon." No one ever thought I would make it this far, and certainly no one thought I'd be at Murray State having the opportunity to talk to you tonight. I have vivid memories of living most of my youth in hospital beds and part of my adulthood, with doctors surrounding me and specialists and nurses all dressed in white surrounding me, all talking about me but never talking to me, and seldom, if ever, asking me a question. Up until recently, when I travel every week, I'm on the road 2, 3, sometimes 4 days a week, every week. And when I go into hotel rooms and put that little plastic key in that hotel door and open up that door, it reminds me not of a hotel room, but of a hospital room and what it felt like to be in those hospital rooms. I was lucky. Somewhere along the way, later on in my life, my diagnosis changed and I grew out of the challenges I was facing. And I was also lucky because when I was a kid, before that happened, I met a coach named Ray Rivers who embraced me and taught me what it was like to have hope, that it was possible to have hope. I had a next-door neighbor who took me in his wood shop next door and taught me how to make things with my hands and to have the confidence that I could do that. There was a guy down the block, a guy named Jack Petker, who took me under and taught me how to fix electrical things and climb ladders when I thought that wasn't possible because the doctors told me I ought not to be doing it. And I did it. But the reason why I'm motivated to do this work is because I remember what it's like to lose hope. I remember what it's like to think that tomorrow, you know, the old saying, tomorrow will be better than today. I remember living day after day thinking that tomorrow actually is going to be worse than today. And I knew that based not on some projection, but based on my experience. I learned what it was like to be invisible, to feel as though you're not seen or heard, that your concerns don't matter, that what you say doesn't matter, that you just follow the rules and go through the system and somehow everything will be all right. And so I'm doing this work because I want to make sure that every person in our communities has an opportunity to be seen and heard. That every person, no matter their current station in life today, that tomorrow has the possibility of being better than today. And 2 years has a much greater sense of possibility than what they have today. I do this work because I want to make sure that we don't simply run people through the system of nonprofits and large institutions, which so often happens to so many people in our communities, because we think we're helping them, when in fact, we're just running them through the mill. It seems to me we've got to be turned outward toward the community to make sure that we're actually working with people, not simply imposing them something on them. And so I tell you this because what I hope it reminds you as I'm speaking is of why you're doing this work, about why you want to be a nonprofit leader, about why you want to help make communities a common enterprise where you're going to be working when you graduate Murray State. Because that urge within you, that thing that motivates you, it's the most precious gift you have. It's more important than any class. I'm sorry I'm saying this at Murray State, but it's more important than any class you will take here. It's more important than any boss you will have. It's more important than any amount of money you will earn. Because as you do this work, you will face adversity, and people in your communities will tell you it's not possible to create the kind of change you're talking about, and you will have bosses who tell you, don't worry about your ideals and what you believe we can do better, just get your job done. And what I hope you'll remember in those moments is that urge within yourself to do good, and that it's the most precious thing you have, and don't let anyone take it away from you, or tell you to discard it, or degenerate it, or denigrate it, or tell you it's not important, because it's the thing you need the most to be a really good nonprofit leader. It's the thing you need the most. And so let me close with this. When I went to Newtown for the very first time, I flew from National Airport in Washington, D.C., up to Hartford. I rented a car and drove 45 minutes over to Newtown. new town's like Murray. It's a relatively small town, 27,000, a little bigger than Murray, 27,000 people. And I went to their town hall, and I drove up, and as I walked into the door to meet with the mayor, before I got to her office, which was on my right, which is also the room where we held all those public meetings about the future of Sandy Hook Elementary School, I saw on a glass window, internal window, two signs hanging there. One sign was a green sign with a white border. It's a sign I have now in my office. And it said, "We are Sandy Hook, we choose love. We are Sandy Hook, we choose love." The second sign was a white sign with a green border. I also have it in my office. And it said, "Our collective strength and resilience will be an example to the rest of the world. Our collective strength and resilience will be an example to the rest of the world." I believe Newtown, a year and a half after that massacre, is demonstrating that. They're coming back. The massacre was a defining moment, but they're making sure that the massacre doesn't come to define that community. And so they are an example. But my hope is that that sign doesn't hang just in Newtown, Connecticut, but that sign hangs here in Murray, in your public library, in your Chamber of Commerce, in this auditorium, in other places in this community. I hope that that sign's hanging in Paducah. I hope that sign's hanging in East Kentucky, in Central Kentucky. I hope every community in this country has that sign, that we have the collective strength and resilience to be an example, not just to the rest of the world, but to ourselves first and foremost, and to the people near and dear to us. We face a choice. We face a choice in this country, and we need you to help make this choice. We can either continue to go down the path that we're on, which no one wants, or we can blaze a different path, one with a greater sense of shared responsibility, a greater sense where we're in something together, and a sense where we're actually working toward our shared aspirations. We need builders. We need people to come out into the community life and build. And we need you in the Leadership Studies program here in Murray State to help lead the way. Thanks so much for having me.